This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
We're going to talk on the programme this evening about Douglas Gageby, who was, as I said at the beginning of the programme, perhaps the great editor, Irish editor of the 20th century. He twice saved the Irish Times. He made the Irish Times into a major media institution in Ireland. He, in the process, made the Irish Times into a major shaper of contemporary Ireland. And to discuss this, we have with us Jim Downey, who's a former deputy editor of the Irish Times, John Hawken, who was very much part of the Irish Times in the 1960s and 1970s, and is now in DCU, Andrew Whittaker, who's editor of the book that we're discussing, which is the title of the book, Andrew?
Bright, Brilliant Days.
Martin Manser, who has an essay in the book, and also Niamh McCafferty, who was in the Irish Times from 1970 to 1977. Douglas Gageby was editor until 1973, isn't that right?
And 73?
He was editor until 1973, then retired, and Fergus
74.
All right.
And then came back.
In 77.
I said at the outset of the programme that Douglas Gageby was probably the great Irish editor of the 20th century. John Hogan, do you agree?
Well, he's the most recent great editor, I suppose. There are other people. The different editors for different times. You know, Geary in The Independent was a very powerful editor in his day and very significant in terms of in a more conservative
way than Douglas was.
He was the editor of The Irish Independent for about 28 years. He started off as a young reporter somewhere in the provinces, reported the Civil War, was sent abroad by the paper, did a lot of particularly interesting stuff for them, but he gave The Independent that kind of stamp that it had and which made it such a successful paper for a large part of the century.
During what period was he editor?
He retired in the late 1950s, so he was of that kind of generation which was old enough to have known both sides in the Civil War and kept on preaching that both sides of the Civil War should settle their differences and get together and form kind of a national government. But he was also conservative in an economic sense, and it was that kind of conservatism which underpinned the success of the Irish Independent with the conservative Catholic middle classes and made it the paper of that group. So he was a very good editor from that point of view.
He would be the only person to challenge Douglas Gageby for the title of the great Irish editor of the 20th century.
Oh, there's a... Well, you didn't ask Timpat onto the programme, so we can't talk about Timpat. I suppose when push comes to shove, of all the editors that whose record I'm familiar with, Douglas would certainly be the best of them.
Would you agree now?
Actually, look, I was just a journalist, a worker amidst all these. When I came south in 1970 and joined the Irish Times, my understanding was it was the equivalent of the English Observer and therefore above tabloid. My understanding was it was the not just the best, but the only paper, and I held to that view all the time. I wrote for it until I noticed round towards the end someone said, you'll find proper, accurate reporting in the Irish press. They're great on reporting. You guys are great on expression and opinion. So it seemed to me that Timpat Coogan held a line at a time of huge censorship and repression, and perhaps he held some kind of nationalist line. But if you're asking me who I love most, Douglas Gageby.
Did you get to know him well?
No, you see, being a journalist, I never got promoted or anything. I was never at an editorial conference, which I gather most other people were.
No,
I was always just outside over a typewriter. He was shy, I was shy, but he used to write me wee notes, and I used to write him wee notes, which I gather didn't happen much. I know that when he resigned in 74 and came back in 77, I wrote a wee note saying, thank God you're back, and he wrote a wee note saying, thank God you're here, and once in a while he'd say that was a good article, or I'd say I liked what you wrote.
Should tell the listeners, Douglas Gageby was born in 1926, was it, 27. He was educated in Belfast, in the Royal Academy in Belfast. He then went to Trinity for a while, then joined the Irish Army, where he acted as an intelligence officer during the war years, then came out and joined the Irish Press Group, then joined the Irish News Agency in 1949-50 with Conor Cruise O'Brien. The Irish News Agency had been established by Sean McBride. Then he went back to the Irish Press Group to be editor, first editor of the Evening Press, stayed there till 1959 when he was poached by the Irish Times, became a joint managing director of the Irish Times from 1959 to 63, then became editor of the Irish Times till 1973 or 74, was
74, it? I think.
74. and then was called back to be editor of the Irish Times again after the Irish Times got into financial difficulties in 1977 and remained there till
86.
And I said at the beginning that he twice rescued the Irish Times from financial disaster. Andrew Whittaker, do you agree with that?
Before I answer, can I put in a word for, I think it was called Bill or William Sweetman, who taught Gageby journalism in the Irish press in the period immediately after the emergency.
Yep.
And he says tremendous things for Sweetman. And Sweetman and his deputy editor, Paddy Kerwin, I think, he credits with tremendous journalistic brio it seems to me from looking at the papers in that time, there was no question but that the Irish press was a super paper, even when it was only 4 and 6 pages, you know, during the war. But to come back, you asked me, did Gageby rescue the Irish Times? He rescued it once in 1978, I think it was, he came back after. It was blasphemously called his second coming by all the journalists. He hadn't rescued it in quite such a vigorous form when he first became editor.
77 he came back.
In 63, when he first became editor, he rescued it, if you like. It was in a long-term slide. It was a very much a minority newspaper, not just in religion, but in sheer numbers. And he turned it round all right. But
it was losing money, had been losing money for a long time. Circulation probably down to 20,000, 20 to 25,000.
Everybody who knows anything except me, I don't know the facts, seems to agree that the circulation was fraudulently misrepresented. It wasn't as high as the 30 to 35 that was publicly claimed, no. But he built it up over a period, over a decade.
To 75,000.
No, that took longer. By the time he retired the second time, he'd say trebled the circulation.
I thought that by the time he had left in 74 that it had gone up to 75,000.
No. It had gone to 60,000.
That's James Downey, yes. All right. Nonetheless, it was a huge achievement to have done that for the Irish Times. But also he made it into mainstream newspaper for the Catholic intelligentsia, it having been the newspaper of the Protestant aristocracy prior to then.
That's the thing I forgot to say. What struck me first about Gageby, he was from the north and he was a Protestant. I'd never met what you might call a liberal or a radical person of the Protestant persuasion from the north. I was stunned.
But also
a great opinion of the north afterward.
But also a nationalist.
Yeah, that's why I said liberal tradition. he was no unionist.
Did you ever know Martin Manser?
Yeah, I met him, I suppose, 3 or 4 times. But, you know, I didn't know him well. But he had a lot of influence on me all the same. I mean, the thing is, he mainstreamed the Irish Times. And I also think it was a very confident voice in the 60s. I'm talking even before the Troubles. I mean, I can remember when I was at Oxford in the mid-60s. There was a copy of the Irish Times in the Oxford Union, and I'd go in every day and read it. And I'm sure the type of coverage that he gave and the feeling that, you know, Ireland was going places at last. I mean, probably played some part in my decision to come back and make a career in Ireland.
He's to blame for you coming back, isn't he?
Not to blame. I'm crediting him maybe with part of the decision. Because there's no doubt about it. I mean, I do not share The sort of vague nostalgia, I think, in Bruce Arnold's thing is that he sort of regrets that it didn't sort of stick to its sort of Protestant unionist, ex-unionist roots. I just have no time for that.
I think one of the things that he did in the early years, before the Civil Rights Movement and everything, he rediscovered the north of Ireland, or he made us all rediscover the north of Ireland, because for most of us, we were fat, comfortable southerners, and the north didn't really exist to a large extent. And he just took reporters who had never been in the north of Ireland, people like Michael Viney, people like Desmond Fennell probably had been in the north of Ireland, but he sent people up to the north to go around, and he gave them an absolutely open agenda, and he turned it into some kind of almost exotic place. So that at least by the time that the civil rights thing started, people who read that paper had a slightly different and more full view about what was happening.
Didn't they call that north of the Black Pig's Dyke or something? What are you talking about? He told me where I came from, then I had to get out a map. That's all. He refers to north as the Black Dyke. What do you call it again?
The Black Pig's Dyke, yes.
Black Pig's Dyke.
It's on the border between Fermanagh and Leitrim.
Yeah, I didn't know that, did I?
Well, you should have known that, seeing you come from Derry.
It seems to me, actually, that you might be critical of him in his view on the North and in the Irish Times coverage of the North, in that the Irish Times, along with all the other newspapers, and perhaps this applies more to British newspapers than to Irish newspapers, never got under the surface of Northern Ireland in the 1960s, never perceived that the reforms being advocated by Captain Terence O'Neill, who was then Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, were thoroughly inadequate, that it didn't begin to deal with the seething anger of a repressed Catholic community. And had that been reported at the time, the convulsion that subsequently happened might have been headed off.
Sorry, Vincent, do you mean before 1968? Because the coverage is fairly good after
that's
that.
That's right, yes.
Yes, but that's a fair point, Vincent. That is correct. And there's a lot of this nostalgic stuff in the book about how he sent Fergus Pyle to cover Stormont and write, allegedly, this isn't quite true, pieces that were longer than the official report, which nobody read, let's face it. Nobody read any of that rubbish. The fact of the matter was that he managed to hold several contradictory ideas about Northern Ireland at the one time. On the one hand, Neil had a point here a moment ago, he said there was no such thing as a liberal or moderate unionist. He wasn't quite right, but he wasn't that far wrong either.
No, it was me that said that.
Oh, he constantly said that to me.
Oh,
now.
Really? Okay, right. Sorry, Jim.
James, aren't we falling into the trap of assuming that Gageby invented the modern Northern Ireland in all its glory and all its hideous brutality? But is it not really true that all the people of the North actually changed themselves? And Gageby was bright enough and had enough money behind him at that stage to send people to report the change. Just as in the South, I think it's quite wrong to think he invented the liberal Catholic who didn't like the Pope or the bishops anymore. Not at all. But he, at least I don't think that's all there is to it. I think he responded to changes that were there in society. But that's the most
my point. Andrew, you would call hideous. We were burning and bombing in 1968, and the man kept an open mind on it. I mean, we were hideous.
My point was, Andrew, earlier on, that had journalism done its job in the 1950s and in the 1960s, they would have uncovered the sore that was Northern Ireland, the repression of the nationalist population and the seething anger of that population. Mm. And had that been done, the convulsion that subsequently happened might have been headed off. And I think you can be critical of
a newspaper
media
can head off a revolution.
I think that the media might have been might have headed it off if it had done its job.
I don't think that was possible. And so I also want to say something that's in Gageby's favour and in that of John Healy. They couldn't do it. Nobody could have done it until the Northern Catholics found their own articulate person and somebody that would be listened to and would talk about the thing in a rational manner that expressed it properly. And of course, I'm talking about John Hume. Now, they went too far in idolising him.
What about Jerry Fitt?
That Indeed, good yes, man. Jerry Fish. But he,
I don't think Eddie McAteer was that bad either.
Nobody would ever listen to Eddie McAteer. Gatesby thought that was a great pity, but he recognised it.
You mean nobody in the South? Isn't this the
nobody
point?
And nobody
making?
In Britain.
The
and
North didn't exist in the southern
okay,
mind.
Can we move on just onto the onto Southern Ireland? And I would have thought that one of the things that he did was hugely important for the Irish Times and also for Southern Ireland was the sending of John Horgan to the Second Vatican Council.
Here, here.
Because I think that if you look back at it, Second Vatican Council had a transformative effect on Southern Irish society, and it had that in part because it was conveyed to us by John Horgan, but also by two outstanding journalists in RTE, Sean McRaman and Kevin O'Kelly. Is that too extravagant, do you think, James Downey?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. And it's one of these many ironies and paradoxes that John Charles McQuaid came home from the council and told us not to bother, that nothing had happened at all. And his successors could argue that seeing they've had a counter-revolution since, that nothing did happen, though to have a revolution, a counter-revolution, that's not the same thing as nothing happening. But the effect it had on society here was absolutely revolutionary and lasting. And the Vatican Council and let's say the coverage of it by John and the other people you've mentioned, and there were some more as well, Louis McRae and Des Fisher,
TPO Mahony, and Donald Musgrave.
Yeah, but surely what it did was show that the church was not
involved. I should have mentioned Louis McRedmond and
what happened with the Vatican Council. I would suggest it showed the ordinary Catholic in the pew that the church, particularly the Vatican, was a worldwide church and the Vatican was only part of it and it was not a monolith and it was okay to have differing opinions. That's what it showed.
But also it sidelined the bishops and it also to some extent, somebody made this point recently, it laicized the church that here were people commenting on church affairs who weren't themselves priests or bishops, like John Horgan. And that had a significant effect.
And it also opened up relations between the churches, which had been fairly sort of standoffish up until then.
That's in the South, isn't
it? Yeah, I'm talking about the South, yes.
Because I should have said that if I'd never met a Protestant like Gatesby, I'd never met a Catholic like John Horgan, John McRaymond, and Donald Foley. Presumably get on to Donald in a minute. It was all news to me coming from the North. I was astonished and charmed by the whole thing then.
The gamble he took, I think, it was not so much sending somebody, because everybody sent for the last session of the Council in 65. It was only RTE had sent to the earlier sessions of the council. They were the only people that had news sense about the importance of this thing then.
Who was the news editor in RTE at the time?
Jim McGuinness.
Former editor of the Irish Press.
Indeed. Yeah. But the gamble he took really was, I think, certainly in relation to anything that I did, was the space he gave me. The Independent wouldn't have given anybody that space, nor would the Cork Examiner, nor would the Irish Press.
Because religion was boring or forbidden?
It just would have been a breach of the convention that you
news
don't
values
news values
to accommodate long
and
reports.
If I wrote 1,500 words a day for a week, he printed 1,500 words a day for a week, and other people would have been cut back to 300 or 400. And the reaction must have encouraged him to continue the experiment.
Well, he did have a very generous allocation of space from board and from the executives there.
Yes.
That was less of a problem for him probably than from any other editor I've ever met.
He told me once that he had a slush fund from the board of X thousand, whatever it was, and that if ever he felt that the paper, the amount of editorial space in the paper was greater, the need was greater than was justified by the amount of advertising, he just put his hand into the slush fund, put another four pages on, and paid for it somewhere down the line.
Well, whether he ever paid for it is a moot point, really, John, because the finances were, shall we say, liberally looked at, especially when the paper started to become profitable. Then, of course, you see, it was while he was out of the place that it became unprofitable again, and very seriously so. That was another matter.
Yeah, and when Nan McCafferty came to the paper in 1970, she was shortly afterwards, she was put on reporting what was going on in the children's courts, and it had, in the eye of the law, and it had a hugely important effect, I felt. But it was the only deference that he gave to reporting on the underside of Irish society that I can recall. And that there were the occasional series of articles, but there was nothing consistently done.
Well, Aileen O'Brien. Michael Viney, perhaps, didn't he do a series about divorce or something?
Yes, Michael Viney
did several.
You're right to that extent, Vincent, but Aileen O'Brien's sort of social sort of column, as it was called, which was a jibe at gossip columns and that sort of rubbish. That lasted quite a long time.
Yeah, but that was weekly, Jim. Vincent's talking about an actual... I mean, I did this thing every day.
Yeah.
It became formal, established practice. But you mustn't also forget, at the same time as I was doing the course, the Woman's Pages had been established when we switched from fashion to contraception. So there's two big subversive things
going on in that paper. That's true as well, yes. Yeah. The feminist revolution, to some extent, was introduced to Ireland by the Irish Times. Mm.
And that's why I'd have to say Donald Foley. I presume Gage gave Foley his head.
Yeah. Donald Foley was Gageby's right-hand man. He became news editor and the other great driving force of the paper of the 1960s and 1970s.
Always a puzzle to me, and there may be people around this table who know more about it, why Donald didn't become editor when Douglas went.
Well, I can answer that, John, because he was a Catholic.
Was it as simple as that?
Yep.
Problems about discipline?
Admitted to me by Douglas Gateby and Tom McDowell. Mm. Though not in so many words, need I say.
What were the words?
I believe, Jim, that you think that influenced our decision.
And then silence.
Mm. Oh, no, there wasn't silence.
I can believe that, I must say. I can believe that.
Thank you, Ross.
The times that we're in it.
Yeah.
This was the times. This wasn't
the early 70s.
Yeah, this was 1973 or 74.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't exactly the Middle Ages.
but allow me to say this. I mean, Protestant institutions were quite slow to acquire Catholic heads. I mean, Trinity College. I mean, they were a bit later on as well. I mean, it's happened, and very good thing it has happened. But I mean, they didn't rush into it.
They were right.
Yeah, I agree. No time for right wing Catholics to be taking over the country. God knows we got it hard enough in the '80s.
Look what's happened, Trinity.
I don't think you're ever Paul Doyle before.
James has just been telling you that they wouldn't like him. James has just been telling you they wouldn't make him an editor because he was a Catholic. Douglas told me in 1978 that I couldn't succeed him whenever he was to go after his second coming because I was a Northern Protestant. And I was absolutely indignant at that because I thought of myself as a Southern Protestant. And that worried me much more than his other judgments. But
Sounds like you were all told the stories.
Yep.
Maybe none of these were good enough.
nobody with any religion.
I'm sure that applied. Donald Foley was a wonderful news editor. I think maybe it was a terrible editor.
Nell, what excuse did they give you for not appointing your editor?
They said, you're no good now.
Let's talk about Donald Foley.
On the odd time we had a joke about it, they said, you must be joking. Mm-hmm. And I was never... management material.
Let's talk about Foley, maybe, because he was crucial to Gageby's success.
Yes,
Foley was the man, and Nell has said this already, really, in more colourful terms than me. Foley was the man with his finger on the spirit of the age. And all that
the
stuff...
woman.
Was that...
I said, careful how you speak. He recruited the woman at a time of feminism. Foley was the man.
Well, no, actually, I'm going to get myself in deep trouble now. But this whole business
Foley
of Foley
more than any man I know.
Has been hugely exaggerated. And what's been exaggerated much more is Gageby and the women. Because Gageby's relations with women, all women, except apparently his wife, because clearly they were madly in love with each other all their lives.
Yeah.
His relations with women were extremely awkward. He was shy, as Nell has said. And the idea, which is expressed by one or two people in this book, that he treated them that he regarded them as equals, is utter nonsense. He certainly did nothing of the kind. He never regarded women as his equals. The only
Who did he regard as his equal?
The only woman that I would have thought he came near to regarding as an equal was Olivia O'Leary.
I can see why that would be.
Why?
Well, because by then feminism, even all the men, even men had begun to understand that feminism is meaningful. They were beginning to look at women in a new light. And Olivia O'Leary, and I say this in the best way, would pass for a Protestant any time. Wonderful woman.
Well, whatever the reason.
Sure, I agree with that.
Oh, you're a real one.
There was a very that was an extraordinary access, but it was very, very important. And remember, am I the only one that says in an essay in this book that Gageby's views were actually very right-wing? He detested, for instance, he detested the National Union of Journalists. He couldn't stand the Irish or the British Labour Party. And no, they're not exactly epitomes of wild, radical socialism.
I couldn't
stand
them. It
was slightly different 30 years ago from what they are today.
James...
The Irish Labour Party.
Is that really true? Because I'm Corish, I'm a Catholic first, and Irish man second. No wonder Gacy couldn't stand them.
James Downey, is this true? Because the fact was that Michael McInerney was political correspondent of the Irish Times from the late 50s until the mid-70s. He was a former communist. He was a member of the Labour Party, I think, throughout all that time. His copy was more biased in a way that I can hardly think of any other journalists then or since. And of course, there were several others in the Irish Times newsroom who joined the Labour Party. You were a candidate for the Labour Party, James Downey, in 1965, as far as I recall.
No, I wasn't. I was a candidate for the Labour Party in 1969 when I was foreign editor.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
It does matter. I had nothing to do with the coverage of domestic politics.
I'm just making
the
point.
And I left the Labour Party before.
There were a lot of people who called themselves lefties around the time. John Hawkham was.
I was sacked for joining the Labour Party from the Irish Times.
When? What year was that?
1975.
That was because. Tell the truth now. You had got permission to stand
this is correct.
In 1973
as an independent senator
for the NUIC.
And my contracts made it quite clear that if I ever ceased to be an independent, they would pull my contract on me. And with my eyes wide open, I decided to join the Labour Party, knowing what was coming down the tracks, and I accepted
that's
my medicine
completely
when I came.
Different.
Oh, okay, but the
who
point
the
I'm making is that,
Pye?
Yes, Douglas Gateby was himself personally a right wing, but he tolerated a
not
very
in the
left,
conventional sense.
He tolerated a very strong left wing coterie, or if you call them that, in the Irish Times in the 1960s, as exemplified particularly by Michael McInerney.
Actually, Vincent, the left wing coterie were exemplified by there were at least six people who were members of the official. So-called official Republican
this
movement.
Was the 70s now.
It changed.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
In the 60s,
70s. Sticky. Liberty Sticky.
Right?
That was the spectrum.
Michael McInerney was unique in that he was one of these ex-communists who remained an idealistic far-left person. He wasn't at all typical of anybody in the Labour Party. He used to write a Labour view of so-and-so at Leinster House was such-and-such. And he meant his own view. The thing was really quite a bit complicated.
Okay, but the point I'm simply making, James, is that there was the left wing, and insofar as it existed in Ireland at the time, was really quite prominently represented in the Irish Times during that time. And that conflicts with your depiction of Gageby as right-wing.
Yeah, you can explain the difference. Gageby was 20 years older than all those young journalists, and he was responding to the zeitgeist in the same way as an editor 20 years older than the staff would have been hiring communists in the 1930s.
Michael McInerney was older than him.
He inherited him.
Well, he gave him free rein.
It was a counterblast.
Okay, we'll take a break and we'll talk about another journalist prominent in the Irish Times who couldn't have been described as left-wing after the break. I said before the break we'd talk about another journalist who certainly wasn't left-wing, who was very prominent in the Irish Times during the era of Douglas Gageby, and that, of course, was John Healy. John Healy had been editor of the Sunday Review, which had he been editor? Yeah, had been editor of the Sunday Review, which had collapsed. It was owned by the Irish Times and had ceased publication in the early 1960s. 64. And he came over with his backbencher column, which he had started in the Sunday Review with Ted Neilan. And the backbencher column was quite influential, I would have thought, in the 60s and 70s. And Healy himself was a huge influence in the newspaper. Very right-wing, but he gave a different slant to things in that his outlook was very rural, west of Ireland. Would you agree with that, James Downey?
I was hoping somebody else would talk about John Healy because I talk about him at some length in my essay. John Healy was used, as I say there, by Gageby as a counterweight to the left-wing people on the paper and to the left liberal ethos generally, because that was more important than the fact that there were a number of left-wingers there. The fact that the newspaper reflected the left liberal ethos to a great deal in its editorials. Remember, on social issues, they're not on economic issues or necessarily on party political issues. Healy was, as I say, a counterweight to this, but also he was there to express what was already a completely out-of-date supposed rural view and supposed rural philosophy, kind of rustic homespun philosophy. That was dying, like the places that he wrote about very movingly too. Mm-hmm. That was all over. And what's more, he knew it. And he ended up in a very peculiar situation, if you try to look at the thing rationally, which was he was demanding state action to save the West, which has now been saved, but not in any of the ways that he wanted it saved.
Knock Airport, Healy backed Knock Airport. That was after he left the Irish Times.
The West hasn't been rustic. Saved by Knock Airport.
Okay, saved it from sinking. Come on. Yeah, I think John Healy... I think what people object to in John Healy, and I loved about him, was he didn't mind Fianna Fáil. Indeed, sometimes supported them. I think that was the counterbalance to the left-wing ethos of the Irish Times, frankly.
It might well have been, but I often wondered about the relationship between Douglas and John Healy. Some of his writings, you know, especially the Nobody Shouted Stop and all that kind of stuff, were very moving and very well done. But I just found myself wondering whether if John was Douglas's sole conduit to this other Ireland.
Yes,
you know, was it
pretty well?
Was there a huge distortion somewhere there?
Surely his importance was quite different. In that he wrote in a very lively and fascinating manner about what one might call the behind-the-scenes machinations of politics.
Yeah.
In, I suspect, a way that nobody had written before. Now, not everybody approved of his style, but he made it really interesting. You know, the intrigues and so on. Mm. I think the rural thing was only one dimension, and on a lot of it he was right, as Nell has said, on the Knock Airport, and we're also going to revive the railway from Sligo to Limerick, which he would have been pleased at.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but I'm here to tell you that they are not going to revive the railway from Sligo.
Oh, yes,
to
they are.
Well,
yes, they
are. Moving along.
The problem is, as somebody said to me, when I finished writing the column in June, is that... I altered some mild criticism that it's, you know, coverage of the rest of the country, attitudes to things like decentralisation and so on. And he said, well, look, you have to realise it's a metropolitan newspaper, and metropolitan is a word that's used more than once in this book. There are times when the Irish Times has not actually been all that good at gauging the rest of the country. I mean, a classic case would be the 1986 divorce referendum. I mean, there was an opinion poll. I think the questions were rather skewed so as to get as positive an answer as possible, which purported to show that two-thirds of the people would support a divorce referendum. Now, I remember people around Fianna Fáil at the time telling me before the campaign had ever started, this will never pass. And, they had more their finger on the pulse than the Irish Times and Gareth Fitzgerald and so on.
All right, we want to come on to a controversial feature of Douglas Gageby's association with the Irish Times, and it was the establishment of the Irish Times Trust. Douglas Gageby, along with, owned 80, tell us about this, Andrew Whittaker. He owned how much of the Irish Times at
the
time?
There were five directors who held an equal shareholding in the shares that were privately held. They weren't on the stock market. There were some shares with very few votes on the stock market, but the privately held shares were owned equally by five directors, and Gageby and Major Tom McDowell were executives. The other three were.
How did he acquire them?
There was a tradition, and it was very old style capitalist tradition, that when you became a director, he was invited to join and became a director, you were expected to take a shareholding in the company. It was a form of commitment, among other things. I never asked him, but I assume he went to the bank and borrowed the money in 1959, and those shares would have come from some retiring director before him. But he had 20%.
Did the Arnott family not own a large part of the Irish Times?
That was a long time back. The Irish Times ownership changed immensely in the period of the 1940s, really, and the Arnotts were gone by then. Were bought out.
All right. Well, tell us what happened to the trust then. The trust was set up in 1973.
Sorry, can you tell me what proportion of his wages or whatever 20% of constituted? He went to the bank. He borrowed the price of a house against his wages, or when you say the share?
I don't know what he paid for them. I mean, that would have been private information. I
assume
simply
a
don't
huge
know
amount. But,
I wonder what it's
compared
been
with his wages, Barn. Mm. I'm sorry,
okay,
Martin,
sorry,
what did you say?
I wonder, would it have been at that time? I mean, values have been so inflated in the past sort of 30, 40 years.
But nonetheless, it's so too have wages. So so what multiple of his wages would have that loan constituted?
Oh, I wonder how valuable the Irish Times was, say, circa 1960.
I reckon, though, that if you bought 20% of the Irish Times then, it would have been a very high multiple of wages earned even by a managing director of the Irish Times.
I think you should look at it rather more the way people buy houses. A man buying shares in a private company would probably take a pretty long-term loan from the bank and would treat it rather like a mortgage.
Okay, and not even. Tell us what happened.
He was also going to get a salary. So
okay, tell us about the trust.
Well, the trust was formed and the trust bought out those directors. And
I think we should just go into a little more detail because the listeners might not understand this. In 1973, it was decided that in order to protect the independence of the Irish Times, that the ownership of the Irish Times should be transferred to a trust from the directors and from the directors and shareholders. And the trust borrowed was it 2 million from the Irish from Bank of Ireland
pounds
to buy the shareholding of the of the then directors and shareholders, and they each got what was at the time a huge amount of money.
Oh, I think it was 320,000 or some figure like that. I forget the detail, but that's the equivalent multiplied by seven. Now it's 3 million today.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the Irish Times was, as some people would say, saddled with that loan, with that burden to pay off over time. But nonetheless, it did secure the independence of the paper.
I don't think that's true, Vincent. I think that the trust has been cracked up to be far more than it really proved to be in the end. It certainly proved to be a ball and chain financially. That's a slightly different story. The real reason the trust was able to borrow the money from the Bank of Ireland was there was huge inflation at that time. The IRA was stalking the streets, and the bank was frightened that the Irish Times would be bought over, in particular by one Roy Thompson, who maybe people don't know his name anymore, but he was a big bad wolf in those days. He was a very successful Canadian businessman, and he went to England.
I don't know if it was the bank that was frightened. My understanding is that, as you know, as you said, the way the paper used to operate was that when any director wanted to go, his shares went back into the pot, were bought by the other directors, and then sold them on to whoever took his place.
That's right.
But as I understand it, two things happened at around the same time. One is that a number of directors, maybe two or three, all decided they wanted to go at the same time. They were all getting a bit older. They had got very little by way of dividends, if anything, by way of dividends out of the paper.
That's right.
That was happening, number one. Mm. Number two, Thompson was sniffing around the place. Number three, the Irish Times had a very, very good year in 72, 73. It was a boom year. So it was a good time to go, but the way I heard it was that it wasn't the bank. The bank would have no particular vested interest in who bought or sold the Irish Times, but the directors had a particular concern that it shouldn't go outside the country.
Roy Thompson made a very convenient excuse for their going to the bank and seeking to borrow $2 million, and the bank agreed. I have a chapter about why that happened.
Yes, you have. And in the chapter you said that the bank was concerned, the bank was made a decision on this, not on the normal commercial or financial, applying the normal commercial financial criteria, but a political criteria, and it was that they wanted the same voice in the context of high inflation and in the context of the instability caused in Irish society by the emergence of the IRA.
That's what I was told. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, businessmen do, when you've got a high risk, I mean, you two risks at that time. I mean, you'd the risk of instability, violence in the north, but you'd also got a great deal of economic, financial instability at the time of the oil crisis. And, I mean, businessmen do take those things sort of considerations when they're taking decisions.
Okay, but it does put a different complexion on the nature of the Irish Times and its role in society. And it is that the role of the Irish Times in society, at least from the perspective of the Bank of Ireland,
was
came
stabilizer.
To the sane voice, sanity being interpreted by the criteria laid down by the Bank of Ireland.
Which would be fairly conservative.
I don't believe that.
Would it have been any more conservative than was being enunciated in the Irish Independent?
Look, think of it this way, if I may. You wouldn't assume if the Bank of Ireland bankrolled some people to buy the News of the World that the bank particularly liked the content of the News of the World. It was bankrolling it as a business proposition and people would buy that sort of paper. I don't think you should make that connection between the views of the bank and the views of the paper. I think it's simply, it's unproven
but
at any rate.
In your own essay, you recall, and it's a fascinating essay, we'll get to it in a moment, and we'll get to it now actually, you recall that in 1977, 76 or 77, you went to Ian Morrison, then head of the Bank of Ireland, and you said a number of things to him, but in the course of your conversation, he said to you that the reason the bank funded the trust was because it wanted a sane voice in Ireland at the time of instability.
That's what he said.
Rings true.
Yes, it does. Which just puts the Irish Times in a certain ideological context, that the role of the Irish Times, as far as its financier was concerned, was to be sane by their conception of sanity.
Well, their conception of sanity was certainly different from high inflation rates and armed Republicans roaming the streets. I don't think that they were terribly conservative to take that view.
It might have been. They might have had other agendas.
And certainly, Gageby did not write leading articles in support of the bank's view. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence for that. But Martin is the expert on his leaders.
They certainly wouldn't have perceived him as in any way menacing the bank's view of society.
That may well be true.
Or the bank's position in society. But
he was an army officer. He was a gentleman, he was a scholar of Trinity.
Yeah, right, yeah.
He was a Protestant.
Yeah. But here was the trust that was set up in 1973 for the purposes of ensuring the independence of the Irish Times, independence from financial pressures or corporate pressures. And here you are.
And from tycoons.
And here you are, Andrew Whittaker, going to the Bank of Ireland, asking the Bank of Ireland to use its clout as financier of the Irish Times to remove the editor.
Yes, that's right. And I'm sure I did the right thing.
The editor being?
Fergus Pyle.
Fergus Pyle was then the editor after Gageby's first retirement. I tell you why I did it.
Getting a bank to remove an editor?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. I did what I believe the trustees of the Irish Times Trust should have done. And had they done it, I wouldn't have had to go and do it.
Did you go to the trustees at the time?
They were completely unapproachable. They weren't. There was a barrier erected between the trustees and anybody on the staff.
What was your position in the Irish Times?
Who do you represent? Did you go to the bank with a balaclava on, say?
No, hold them up. No, I was a middle-ranking executive of the company at that time. I was corporate development manager at that time, I think.
But you took it on yourself to go to the bank?
Absolutely. The paper was going bust.
Nobody knew but you?
the paper was going bust.
I'm just interested to talk about Pinochet being dead. Nobody knew but you that you were going off to the bank to say...
Absolutely. Well,
Melissa, who's going to happen in business life?
That's exciting. I didn't know this.
Just to cast... I hope cast a little bit of light into this same room, though perhaps a different corner. Before ever that happened, before Andrew went to see Ian Morrison, there was a huge plot afoot involving the Bank of Ireland, the chairman, and
chairman of what?
Of the Irish Times Trust, and the National Union of Journalists.
To do what?
To bring back Gageby.
Oh, well, that was happening when I was a journalist. There was practically a petition got up. I remember that.
How do you know this was before Andrew Whittaker went to the
Bank? Because I was there.
Yeah. But were you with Andrew Whittaker?
No. I was there.
But how do you know that it was before that?
Because I was there, present.
Did you know
physically?
That Andrew Whittaker had gone to the bank?
No, I didn't, but he gives the date in the book.
Does he give the date? Do you give the
March,
date?
Not in March 77, yeah.
Yes.
I don't know when this
exactly.
palace coup, the gym...
The revolt against Fergus Pyle began almost at once.
The
revolt against Fergus Pyle began almost at once. These things are...
You were unaware of the fact that there was seething revolt in the newsroom at the time?
No, I was very well aware of it, and I sent memos to the chief executive, who was my direct boss.
And why did you then feel it necessary to go to the Bank of Ireland to
get them to use their clout? Because the chief executive was removed... And Fergus was kept as editor, quite the reverse of the two things the paper most urgently needed. The paper was going bust. It was a matter of weeks before the net worth was going to be zero. Right, and there was a real risk that the bank could legitimately have put a receiver in. That's another thing that
happened. But you urged them to do that.
Yeah. I did, of course.
Why did they listen to you? Who were you to go and tell the bank what to do?
But they didn't, did they?
I'm curious.
It's hard to tell. They certainly removed Fergus, but they took some months after that to do so.
But deal with Nell's point.
Why would
answer
they
Nell's
to me?
Question? No. Nell's question was, why did you... wasn't it presumptuous of you to take upon yourself? You're a mere employee. What were you doing going behind everybody's bank, going to the Bank of Ireland, asking them to exercise their...
Maybe Superman now here. That's what I want to know.
You seem to take the view that nobody must talk to the bank except the managing director.
But I think...
Why would that be?
It was fairly presumptuous of you.
Why did the bank listen to you? Of course I can go to the bank and say, get rid of Vincent Brown and RT, they're going down the tubes. Why did the bank listen to you?
I suppose they knew me because I had been the business editor for some years before that. And that gives a certain confidence. They know who they're talking to. That's a possible human reason why they might listen. Secondly, I was well armed with figures and I knew my facts and figures.
You had good relations with the Bank of Ireland?
No, not in any personal sense, no.
Well, you're a wee revolutionary, aren't you? If what you're saying is true, because I'm kind of lost here, Vincent.
This unknown
employee walks into a bank and says, get rid of Fergus Pyle.
Yeah.
Right, they say. This is wonderful.
No, they didn't say right. He didn't say right.
Well, it took him a couple of months.
No, there's no evidence that the bank exercised any influence on what happened, is there?
There is no evidence that I can produce. There's no document that I know of. Well, there may be in the company's files. Jim may know what went on.
Do you believe that as a consequence of your visit to Ian Morrison, then chief executive of the Bank of Ireland, that the Bank of Ireland had an influence in removing the editor?
Yes, I do believe that. And I believe it because the bank had other accesses to information in the company at that time. One of the trustees, I forget how many trustees there were probably a dozen or so. One of them was a former governor of the Bank of Ireland. And
Don Carroll?
Don Carroll.
He was then governor of the Bank of Ireland, wasn't he?
No, I don't think he was governor at that time. He had been the previous year or something like that. I've forgotten the exact timing of his appointments. Mm. But he would...
It's great to think that the Trust established the independence of the Irish Times, independent from all these vested corporate interests. That's what the whole thing was about.
What the Trust needed was the sort of initiative that I took. And let me tell you, the Scott Trust, which has been tremendously successful in preserving the real independence of the Guardian in England, is quite different from the Irish Times Trust, which was not modelled on it. The Scott Trust had one of its objectives in writing, and they've adhered to it, to make money to save the Guardian.
Okay. Can I just ask you another question? And it's this, that in the book that you have edited and presumably you take responsibility for what is published, Kevin Myers describes Douglas Gageby as a crook.
Mm.
Do you think that was fair? Do you think that, that would you have published that if Douglas Gage had been alive?
I'm not going to go into the detail all of that. Some people think it's in very bad taste, and I can well see why they do.
Do you mind the detail? Would you have published that had Douglas Gage been alive?
It's a totally impossible question to answer because he had to be gone. It wasn't that he was dead. The fact is he left the Irish Times 20 years.
Do you think it was right to call him a crook?
I wouldn't have done it myself.
Do you think he was a crook?
I don't think he was a crook.
Do you think Kevin Myers is wrong to call him a crook?
No, Kevin Myers speaks for himself.
Do you think he was wrong to call him a crook?
No, I'm not going to answer that question. My job as editor was to carry a range of...
It's quite outrageous, in my view.
Just have been a fool.
But of course, I mean, Kevin Myers, I mean, is known for using hyperbole of all kinds. I mean, it's not even to be taken remotely literally.
The word crook must be taken literally?
Well, not around in his pen, no.
Anyway, in spite of that...
It's outrageous, all the same.
It's an excellent book, and it's called again, Andrew?
It's called Bright Brilliant Days, and there are something like 25 different writers in it, and, you know, we owe a lot to them.
No, all right, we need we another leave chapter. I'm really intrigued.
We've got to leave it. The production team tonight is Kevin Barnes, Annette Egan and Michael Campion. From us tonight, good night.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie.